Hello and welcome to the Muni Lowdown podcast. My name is Paul Graves and I'm the managing editor for Detwine Municipals. Joining me today is one of our fantastic reporters, Deb Pace. The podcast title for today's episode is Life's a Breach, Cybersecurity Challenges. Deb, how you doing?
Great, Paul. Thank you.
Well, this is another interesting topic that we're going to delve into today. And I want to just set the background to this. You know, last year, I want to say maybe it was in August, I started noticing disclosures reporting on cybersecurity incidents. And well, the first thing I noticed was the disclosure was usually pretty inadequate and you didn't really get a lot of information. And I also noticed how the disclosures also seemed to make it seem like, well, this is not really a problem. Everything is fine. No data has been breached, which was kind of curious to me because then why even report it? So I thought it made sense to have a broader discussion about what's going on in a number of different sectors in the market. And one thing I'll set as a background in terms of what seemed to be a catalyst for these efforts around cybersecurity in the municipal space is the executive order that President Biden signed in May of 2001 on cybersecurity. And a key part of it was this framework called Zero Trust Architecture. And there are these five pillars. And we're not going to go into a deep dive, but basically this whole idea of assume you have a breach, assume that it's a war that you cannot win. Assume that the best you can do is incremental improvements over time when it comes to cybersecurity and that it's a journey. And these five pillars, just real quickly, are people trust, device trust, network trust, application trust, and data trust. That is the framework that all municipal issuers and borrowers should be operating under going forward to kind of deal with these threat actors. But let's take it into some examples here, because, you know, cyber attacks are now a part of everyday life and they're affecting different industries and sectors. What have you seen in terms of general challenges?
Well, so much. I mean, what you said is it's a journey and we're seeing it across municipalities. There's organizations such as Puerto Rico Aqueduct and Sewer Authority. So they couldn't read water meters after an attack and their billing and collections were an issue. And then also the Commonwealth government in general said they lack enough workers to respond to the cyber attacks. They're constantly being experienced by the island's agencies. So there were 600 cyber attacks against the government servers and computers on the island just in 2022. And then if you expand out into the continental U.S. here, Suffolk County, New York, the organization that claimed responsibility for the attack demanded ransom, said it had hacked not just the county, but its network of contractors and its contracts with the state. So there you have a domino effect as the vulnerability expands. In Fremont County, Colorado, last September, they didn't announce cyber attacks for 2 days and had to put up a temporary website and close down several departments that couldn't operate after the cyber attack. And then Oak Ridge, Tennessee, one of the most recent municipal attacks we've covered here on DebtWire, they couldn't accept payments for city services such as utilities after a malware attack last week and said they would likely have to push court dates back by 30 days.
So you mentioned a few municipalities and the challenges they're dealing with. The hospital sector has also been a big target of cyber criminals. Well, what are the issues that are created that might be separate and distinct to what you're seeing with municipalities?
So this becomes kind of like a lawsuit filing where it encompasses everything we've talked about above. Plus, it's not just systems or servers being down. In the case of hospitals such as UMass and Lake Charles Memorial, they're each facing several lawsuits where you have patient data that was accessed during the attacks that's protected under HIPAA. So violations are the central theme. And in the case of UMass, it's facing several lawsuits related to a Facebook tracking code that it installed on its website resulted in Facebook and other third parties gaining access to patient data. So there's also lawsuits over its payroll vendor Kronos had a ransomware attack. And the lawsuits, several of them, allege that UMass failed to pay its employees on time. Then we move over to Common Spirit Health. Similarly, it's facing a wage theft class action lawsuit from Oregon Nurses Association members for its October 2022 attack that temporarily shut down the system's electronic timekeeping systems. Now, the suit alleges that nurses still haven't hasn't been paid for their hours worked after the attack, and that the health system improperly held what it said were overpayments. The number of ransomware attacks against hospitals and other health organizations doubled in the 5 years up to 2021. Hackers have accessed the personal information of nearly 42 million patients. So it's definitely a problem that's not going away, Paul.
And unfortunately, the threat activity doesn't stop there. Education has been a big target. And even within education, you can break it down between challenges that have been faced between higher education and in school districts. How are they being targeted and affected?
Right, Paul. A big one. LA Unified School District suffered a cyber attack during Labor Day weekend last year, and it was such a large-scale attack that it took down the district's website and email servers and basically crippled its ability to function, including online classes. The district's board gave the superintendent emergency spending powers to help handle the crisis, and he was able to bypass critical functions that the district uses, such as competitive bidding. It led to several weeks of disruptions and decades of personal student data, ultimately being posted on the dark web after it failed to pay ransom in the attack. And also, I wanted to keep in mind, too, that under these, they don't immediately know of what data was breached. So when you talk about their necessarily denying some of these things have happened, it takes months and sometimes even longer for them to really understand the true repercussions of the attack and the extent of the attack. So then we have Des Moines Public Schools. In January, they closed classes for a few days after losing computer systems in a cybersecurity event, as they're calling it. It included leaked data, and now it has to push back the last day of school by 2 days. So add that on to the costs for the school year. And some institutions are retargeted. In higher education, for example, Sierra Joint Community College District in California last August suffered a second cyber attack in 2 years with a ransomware attack by criminal hackers. Though the institution said a faster recovery from the second attack was possible because of improvements made after the first attack in May of 2021.
So we hear these words, you just said it, criminal hackers, cyber attacks. Who's responsible for this? And who's being, when we hear these terms, who are we referring to?
There are a number of them, and there's a few big ones. In the case of PRASA and LA Unified, the ransomware gang called Vice Society is known for cyber attacks on educational institutions. So they use what's called double extortion. It's a common ransomware operation tactic where victims are pressured to pay a special ransom amount in exchange for decryption and to avoid having sensitive data published on the attacker's dedicated leak site. Though there's no guarantee afterwards that the data won't find its way onto the dark web, especially in the case of PRASA, because they opted not to pay the ransom. Now, in the case of Suffolk and Fremont counties, Black Cat is the ransomware family that typically targets high-profile organizations and the ones responsible for those attacks. It's called triple extortion, though, where they launch distributed attacks on targeted infrastructure and coerce them to pay the ransom. Now, the why of all of this is that it pays. The more sophisticated the attacks, the more likely they'll see a payday, and ultimately, these groups have several players and they pay them sometimes up to 90% of what they get in the ransomware. So it's not just some head of an organization saying, I'm going to hack them. This is groups all over the world who are responsible.
So how are they doing it and what makes them successful?
Paul, the short answer is that the groups target organizations and agencies that often have older hardware and outdated operating systems. Sometimes they even lack data security roles in the organization. Data security until recently weren't given as much, if any, attention in the budgets. And the cyber criminals are constantly scanning networks to exploit weaknesses. And in the case of PRASA and the Puerto Rico in general, they've said they don't have enough people.
So in order to get a complete picture of how cyber attacks are affecting municipal issuers and borrowers, we have to look at not only the attacks, right, but the recovery. And in some cases, that recovery cost could be quite large. Tell us a little bit more about that.
So in all of the cases, you'd have the cost of the ransom if they pay it. Plus, in the case of Suffolk County, it's hiring a C-level executive. It's a chief information security officer who will front the defense that comes with six and, you know, many times multiple six-figure salaries and benefits. So you have the cost of adding staff roles to handle data and cybersecurity, which further strains tight municipal budgets to begin with. You don't often see an actual cost provided. So in many organizations, the true cost can be tough to pinpoint. However, common Spirit recently put $150 million price tag on its cybersecurity incident. That includes lost revenue from business interruption, and insurance recovery is questionable and unpredictable in cases such as that. In 2022, an IBM data report put the cost at just over $10 million per incident, with the costs accruing for more than 2 years after an incident. And with budgets so tight following the pandemic and emergency funds running out, you're likely to see entities seek funding from their state or federal government.
So obviously with these incidents, there's government funding that's being eaten up to deal with these costs. And there is already some federal funding help out there. Do you think it's enough?
Without saying a straight yes or no, it really just begins to scratch the surface of what's needed. With the ransomware threat to state and local governments growing, and you know, parts of the $1 trillion Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, it's going to be targeting protecting state and local governments from cyber attacks. So there's going to be grants available. There's a lot of money and a lot of attention being put toward this. But honestly, the short answer is no. As you said in the start of the podcast, it's a journey. So as we learn more about it, and as we start to really defend it in our municipalities, we're going to find ourselves needing more and more funds to address it and to defend against it.
Well, this exactly wasn't the happiest podcast I've been able to participate in, listening to all these challenges. I mean, does it seem like municipal issuers and borrowers are getting a handle on this, or is it we really have a long way to go?
I think you see really two sides of the coin, Paul. You have some who are really at the forefront and have been sometimes even proactive, who understand it, but maybe don't even have the budgets to address it yet. I think that there's that side. And then there's the other side. You have some of your smaller credits, smaller municipalities that really don't even know where to begin because they're trying to find ways to pay for salaries and pensions of current employees without adding data and cybersecurity whole departments that they'll need to defend against this. So it's such a really deep and long question we could talk about for hours, but I really think that it's something that won't go away. The costs are going to increase, but as we become more aware, I mean, you see it just in our organization where there's constantly emails and things sent around, and you have to just be more intelligent and more aware as a municipality, as a user of some of the things that make us vulnerable, our laptops in working from home. And so we need to just have education and budgets to be able to address some of these risks that are constantly evolving. So our education has to do the same.
So it sounds like there's going to be a need for some internal assessment across governmental entities and proper planning to kind of make sure we strategically address these concerns. But thanks, Deb, for a very enlightening presentation on these cybersecurity risks. And thank you for listening to the Muni Lowdown. Please support us by liking, sharing, and or subscribing on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Join us every Thursday for the latest drop of the Muni Lowdown. Take care.